Good morning. So again, I'm happy to be here with all of you studying together the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. So I feel a little bad in a way that for the 3 days of the session, I'll be giving two of the talks and Dokai one of the talks. But that's because we really wanted Dokai to give the talk on Sunday and didn't want him to have to give three talks. So anyway, hopefully we'll see how it goes, but I had an idea that perhaps I would leave a little bit of time at the end of my talks in case Dokai wanted to say something, because we have this great opportunity to have him here with us. And thank you again for coming. So I want to just say a little bit. Dokai talked a little bit last night about the, you know, sort of overall what this is, this poem, this song. But I'll just say a few more things about that. So the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, it's a Zen poem. It's from classical Chinese, and it appeared during the Song Dynasty. And it's often usually attributed to Dongshan Lianjie, or in Japanese, Tozan. And Dongshan is the co-founder of the Soto branch of Zen Buddhism. So it's really a poem or a song that's solidly in our lineage, except when you look at some modern research that says, well, maybe Dongshan didn't actually write this. But even if he didn't write it, it's pretty sure that he knew about it. So Taigen Dan Leighton has a book called Just This Is It, that's actually a lot about Dongshan and Dongshan's teaching on suchness or thusness, which is what this poem is about. And in that book, Taigen says that one source has that Dongshan said that this teaching, this poem or song, was secretly entrusted to him by his teacher, who was Yunyan. So anyway, in a way, so for people who like to know these things, that's important. And I guess it's important to look at, you know, what we can know to be true historically. But we also can know what can be true dharmically, so how we can learn from it. So it might be nice to think about this song written by Dongshan, but it also might be nice to just say, well, what can we learn from this song, whoever wrote it, wherever it came from? One thing that we do know is that it has been studied since the early 12th century as a work of Dongshan. And we also know that it became part of a daily chanting in, I think, like the 1700s. So it's been in Soto Zen monasteries for about 300 or a little more than 300 years. I think maybe late 1600s, early 1700s is when it started being chanted regularly. So another thing to think about with this song is that, and this is again partly from Taigen and partly from my own experience of this poem, is that the images and the metaphors that we find here are meant to evoke and inspire. So many of the characters and the phrases that are in this poem have multiple levels of meaning. And there can be references, like they can be referring to something, and we'll look at that, we'll talk about that. But to me, it's also important to consider what this song evokes in you and how it inspires you. So that's kind of how I'd like to proceed. And let's see, make sure I have a timepiece. So I thought it's interesting to think about or to look at some of the various translations of the title. Of course, there's various translations of the whole thing, but I'm not really going to get into that, at least not today. But here's some different translations of the title. The Song of the Jeweled Mirror Samadhi. The Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. So whether it's a jewel mirror, a mirror made of jewels, or a jeweled mirror, a mirror with jewels. The Sacred Mirror Samadhi. The Samadhi of the Invaluable Mirror. That's kind of interesting. And the Song of the Bright Mirror Samadhi. So one thing about the, so there's a lot of the translations have jewel in them. And for me, that's evocative of Indra's net. So Indra's net, the kind of metaphoric view of the universe or of everything, where there's this enormous net, and in each node of the net, there's a jewel. And each jewel reflects all the other jewels and everything else. So each point, each jewel is at the same time the whole thing. So that the jewel mirror samadhi evokes that for me. This beautiful and kind of mind-blowing view of what is. And I brought up this song in our Teacher Rio meeting, the teaching group, to ask for some help in let's try to understand this together and get more wisdom. So I had talked to Dokai, had a long Skype meeting where we talked about what it is and then getting help from others. And now today we're doing it together, although I'm doing most of the talking, but I hope that in you, what it evokes for you. So one person said, I think it was Fish, that it's about the preciousness of this life. So the precious jewel, the precious mirror, the preciousness of this life, and the beauty. So it's not just something that's reflecting, it's a jewel, so it's beautiful. And we also remembered that from the Yogacara teachings, there's a teaching that when delusion is overcome, store consciousness, so the base of consciousness, becomes great mirror wisdom. So when the delusions or the ego grasping of manas, that kind of consciousness is transformed through our realization, then we see that our afflictions are none other than enlightenment. And then this jewel mirror, samadhi, is made manifest. So I'd like to just read the section that I'm going to, might not get through it all, but the section that I'm going to be talking about this morning. The Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it, preserve it well. A silver bowl filled with snow, a heron hidden in the moon. Taken as similar, they are not the same. Not distinguished, their places are known. The meaning does not reside in the words, but a pivotal moment brings it forth. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. Just to portray it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. In darkest night, it is perfectly clear. In the light of dawn, it is hidden. It is a standard for all things. Its use removes all suffering. Although it is not constructed, it is not beyond words. Like facing a jewel mirror, form and reflection behold each other. So I just like to look at that section line by line and explore that together. The Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. So we might know Dharma as reality or truth or teachings. And thusness or suchness is kind of hard to define, but we might say it's the fundamental reality, including the particulars and beyond the particulars. That would be maybe one way. That's what I'm going to say right now in this moment. And then there's this word intimately. The Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. So I was reminded that this word and this concept of intimacy was very important to Katagiri Roshi. And I think it's very important to me too. And it's been important to many of my teachers. My first teacher, the first Rakusu that I had, actually didn't have my Dharma name on the back. It was written, "This Life Intimate." So that's a great teaching. Just be here, be very intimate with your life. And this was a practice that Dungshan also did. There's a story from case 98 in the Book of Serenity. A monk asked Dungshan, "Which of the three bodies of Buddhas does not fall into any category?" Dungshan responded, "I am always close to this." So that's the kind of answer that I used to really hate when I was first when I was first coming to Buddhism and Zen. But if we look at it closely, we can see it's really maybe not so mysterious. Because what is the monk really asking? So, you know, you might know about the three bodies of the Buddha. I'll just say there's the Dharmakaya body, the body of essence or unmanifested body. There's a Sambhogakaya body, which is the body of enjoyment or the heavenly body. There's a Nirmanakaya body, the body of transformation, or the body of this and that, the body of the earthly mode. So anyway, that's a teaching, there's three bodies of the Buddha. So then this monk is trying to say, well, yeah, but what about oneness? What about beyond categories? So which body of the Buddha is the best that is about oneness and doesn't fall into any categories? But so he's really asking, what's the category that's no categories? So he's still trying to make a category. There's three bodies, and now he's thinking there's one body that's really beyond categories. But so what's that category? And Dungshan just kind of cuts through all of that talk and says, really, it's intimacy, just being close. Whatever is arising. So I am always close to this. I mean, if we want to think about it, we could think he's close to the monk. He's close to the monk's questioning mind. He's close to the urge for us to understand and put things in categories. And he's close to all of the categories and beyond the categories. So he's just intimate with everything. And he doesn't fall into the trap of, you know, then describing like I just did. So I'm always close to this. Just being intimate. So when Taigen talks about this line, he says that it's sort of telling us what's coming in the poem, in the song. And what's coming is to say the poem is about the depths of reality the teachings about this reality, and about how we can engage with this reality, with suchness or thusness. But of course, we don't, in a way, we don't have to engage with it because we already have it. That's the next line. Now you have it. Preserve it well. So this is the, it's very simple. It's right here. It's right in front of us. I really liked a story that I heard at the Soto Zen Buddhist Association conference a couple weeks ago. I wish I could remember who told this story. But anyway, that's that. I don't remember. But here's the story. There was a priest at the SCBA conference, and she spoke about wanting to come to Sesshin for the first time. So we have someone here for the first time. Anyway, she wanted to come for the first time, and she asked her teacher, well, is there anything I need to know, or is it okay if I come? Are there any prerequisites? I mean, should I have something, do something first? Anyway, so she was just wanting to kind of, like, is it okay if I come? And he answers, no, you don't need anything. You already Buddha. You come, you sit, you remember. So that really struck me. You know, and we sometimes here have had introduction to Sesshin. We kind of take care of people, and it's good. I think it's good to take care of people. But it's also good to remember that we're already Buddha, so we can come and sit. And I think the preserve it well is that's the part where we come and sit to remember. That's how we preserve it well. It's not like grabbing onto it or trying to make something eternal out of it, but it's preserving the activity of remembering that we are Buddha. So as I mentioned before, this poem or song started being chanted regularly, like daily, in monasteries about 300 years ago. But before that, it was kind of kept secret and only transmitted orally for a while. And then it was chanted for a while, and then it became part of the regular chant. So Taigen says that when it started being chanted communally, the meaning kind of shifted in a subtle sense, this meaning of now you have it, preserve it well. So if it was a secret transmission, like just one-to-one, like a Dharma transmission thing, now you have it, preserve it well, one teacher to one student, kind of special and secret, that's one thing, and that's fine. But then when we chant it together, there's a subtle sense that all of us who chant it now have it. Of course, that was true before too, but now you know, it's made manifest in the poem. So I'd like to read something from Taigen's book about this line. So he writes, the teachings are intimately transmitted so thoroughly by the Buddhas and ancestors that our experience of suchness in this moment may be an encounter with them now. So I want to say that again because that's pretty powerful. The teachings are intimately transmitted so thoroughly by the Buddhas and ancestors that our experience of suchness in this moment may be an encounter with them now. So they are here with us now, the Buddhas and ancestors. And then he goes on, hopefully it will not be relegated or dismissed by anyone as merely conventional poetry or philosophy. Some range of awareness of suchness may be a consequence of meditative practice. Thus, the poem suggests that all practitioners somehow preserve and care for whatever experience of suchness has been intimately conveyed from the practice and teaching. So now we have a responsibility And even if we're thinking, well, my experience of suchness is like this or gone, it's nothing. That doesn't matter. And our ideas about it don't matter. But we now have a responsibility, hearing the teachings here and now, that the Buddhas and ancestors are transmitting to us here and now. And now we have a responsibility to preserve and care for that. So the next line, a silver bowl filled with snow, a heron hidden in the moon. So this is pretty kind of standard metaphors for non-discrimination. Usually, we hear about the kind of non-discrimination metaphors with images of darkness, like in the night. But here, it's images of light, like something is so light and so bright that the background comes to the foreground. A heron hidden in the moon becomes so bright that the heron is hidden. Or the silver bowl with snow. Well, that there's not a background there. I don't know what's the background and what's the foreground, because there's these two things. The idea is, I mean, I think, well, I'd be able to see snow in the silver bowl, but I think the idea is that the snow is kind of silvery and the bowl is silvery, and then you can't really distinguish where the bowl ends and the snow begins. There's also a poem by Dogen. So this is many hundreds of years later, that kind of combines the two images of the snow from the one and the heron from the other. So here's his poem. A white heron hiding itself in the snowy field where even the winter grass cannot be seen. So again, it's the background, the snowy field, suchness coming forward. And then the objects that are in the foreground just disappear. The world of this and that disappears. However, taken as similar, they are not the same. Not distinguished, their places are known. So the white heron in the snowy field, it's disappeared. It's similar. It's the bowl and the of snow and the silver bowl. It's the moon and the heron. So it's okay, it's disappeared. And yet, those things are still individual objects. So this is also the teaching of the harmony of difference and sameness, the Sandokai. Whereas grasping at things is surely delusion, according with sameness is still not enlightenment. So we can't just say everything is mush. So even though the background comes forward, the things that are in the foreground, like the heron or the winter grass, still exist. And if you walked out into that field, you would either step on the heron or you would hear the heron fly away. The meaning does not reside in the words, but a pivotal moment brings it forth. You can't find thusness or suchness by figuring it out. You can't find it through logic, through being clever, or through having the right thing to say. I think that's one of the things that used to bug me about the koans, because I thought it was about being clever and having the right thing to say. And I didn't understand. It seemed like mumbo jumbo. But that's not suchness. So what they were saying was intimate. And if I didn't understand, it was because I was, well, there might have been some sort of cultural context that I was missing, but also I was trying to figure it out with logic. But it's also not about saying nothing. So later on, we'll hear, it is not beyond words. But I think it's important to know that the meaning does not reside in the words. And it's important to remember that because mostly, I think for most of us, our minds want to understand with words. And our minds are constantly secreting thoughts which very quickly turn into words. So how can we let go of this? So this is often a challenge during sesshin or longer meditation when we notice the words and words and words and thoughts and thoughts and thoughts arising. Can we let the words and the thoughts float by like clouds in a clear sky? Can we allow ourselves to open to the pivotal moment? So what is this pivotal moment anyway? So here we find the character ki, which means has a lot of different meanings. It means function, operation, workings, mechanism, pivot, opportunity, energy, capacity, student, loom, as in a weaving, or even, this is from Taigen, even the moving power of the universe. So this word ki in this pivotal moment, that's the character ki. So here's what Taigen says about that. With the energetic pivotal opportunity occasioned by the inquiring impulse or questioning student's sincere effort, the reality of suchness does respond. So that's the pivotal moment brings it forth. So that's kind of good to know. I mean, it's important to know that it's not our effort alone that's the pivotal moment. It's not like we have to do it all. But we do something. So there's that image of we turn the wheel. We turn the Dharma wheel, and the Dharma wheel turns us. So that's pivoting. So we sit in sesshin. We make our sincere effort, letting go of outcome. That can be challenging. Like, all right, a pivotal moment brings it forth. I want it to come forth. But that's a real trap, so... So we make our sincere effort, and then we make our sincere effort to let go of outcome. And then there's an opportunity. There's a pivotal moment that can arise. Then the background comes into view, and we are hidden in it. Just like the heron hidden in the moon. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. So in our teacher group, we thought, oh, this is really meditation instruction. Don't move. Don't, and not just physically, but don't be trying to escape from your life as it's arising, whatever's arising in this moment. Cultivate calm abiding. And then know that when you try to get away, you may fall into a trap. And the trap can be of doubt and vacillation, or it can be of regret and self-hatred. So I've been in that trap, which is kind of about first making a big effort and then moving. Like, okay, now I give up, or I can't do this, or whatever comes up. And then I see that I've missed the opportunity. So rather than just turn and wait for the next opportunity, there may be a tendency to wallow, right? So that's where we might say to ourselves, I'm no good at meditating. I'll never get this. I'll never be enlightened. What good is enlightenment anyway? You know, a story can go like that. But that's really not the way to work with suchness. And that's not the instruction. So that's a warning. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. You've missed the opportunity. And you might fall into doubt and vacillation. But then there's further instruction. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. And actually, you can't escape suchness any more than you can escape being made up of atoms. You might try to turn away, or you might try to grab onto it, and both are problematic. But Dogen, many hundreds of years later, tells us, he doesn't say it like that, this exactly, I think, but even if you walk into the fire of suchness or try to run away from suchness, both of those are suchness. So sometimes you hear that, or I hear that, and I think, oh, well, I don't have to do anything. Well, I still have to make my sincere effort. The key, K-I, key, energy, pivot, opportunity, student, needs to come forward. But I don't have to worry if I've made a mistake by turning away or touching, grasping or avoiding. I can just say, oh, that's suchness too, and then return to my sincere effort. The teachers studying this also really liked the burning part of the massive fire, because we recalled that in many traditions, the fire represents the sacred, like Moses and the burning bush. Or I thought of the idea that I've heard, which is, if you look into the face of God, you'll die. It's like too much. It's the sacred is too overwhelming to go toward in that way. But you can still encounter it. You just can't touch it. You can't grab it. You can't make it into yours. And also, you can't run away. You can't escape. So this is partly from my Catholic upbringing, the idea of a loving God that you can't escape. Even if you, no matter how much you sin or try to run away, always that love will be there. That presence will be there. So in my mind, I just, when I learned about thusness or suchness, I thought, oh, that's really God in a way that takes it away from the personal and all the problematic things with the images of God that people have created. So instead, it's just a massive fire. It's a sacred fire. And there's also the idea of the fire metaphor as you could see the fire as difficulties, like the difficulties in your life, the massive fire of the difficulties in your life. And you don't have to touch it and be burned up by it, but also, so don't foolishly walk into the fire. Don't wallow in your pain when the difficulties arise. But also you stay close and abide and cultivate a tolerance for being uncomfortable and being with difficulties. So that's also a kind of meditation instruction. Well, so then we have this line that's kind of funny after all this poetry. Just to portray it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. So, and yet here is this poem, this song. So this is just like a little warning. Also, don't get lost in the beauty of it. And don't make it into just a fine literary thing. And I think Teigen said that in his thing, like, hopefully we don't, what was it? Hopefully it will not be relegated or dismissed by anyone as merely conventional poetry or philosophy. So we don't want to go there. that would be staining it with defilement. And there's a danger, even just by putting down these words, that there's a danger of staining it with defilement. And then maybe as kind of a way to remedy that, the next line is talking about the night. In darkest night, it is perfectly clear. In the light of dawn, it is hidden. So this is the, you know, the more traditional metaphor of suchness being, you know, in when it's dark, you can't see this and that. So suchness or profound interconnection, the whole works, is perfectly clear. When we let go of this and that thoughts, when we drop off attachment to body and mind, then there it is, perfectly clear. But then in that next thought where there it is, then that's the sunrise. Say, oh yeah, I saw something there. But, you know, that's okay. So then you're saying, yeah, I saw something there, but that's not it anymore. Then that's me saying I saw something there. That's how it works. So Shodo Spring, who's part of our study group with the teachers, talked about something she heard, which was like a research study on gymnasts. And the gymnasts were asked, like when they were performing, you know, they'd sometimes you perform and, you know, it's beautiful and everything's perfect, and other times people fall. They make a mistake and they fall. So when they asked them, what were you thinking? What was in your thoughts at that moment or right before that happened? And when they fell, they could all say, oh yeah, I was thinking this is a hard move, or I wonder, you know, am I going to do this right, or should I, you know, am I balanced, or whatever. They were thinking something, or maybe they were thinking, oh, that really hurt when she said that to me, you know, whatever. They could identify exactly what they were thinking before they fell. But when they were asked, okay, now you did that move just perfectly, everything was just right, what were you thinking? They'd say, I don't know. I can't say. I don't remember. Nothing. But it's not to say that we just cultivate always, you know, having no idea, but to me, it points to, because I have a mind that, like, always I want to think and I want to know what I was thinking. I want to, you know, identify the stream of thoughts. That's like my default. So hearing like this poem of suchness and hearing about this study, it's like, okay, there's really a lot more to it than what I can wrap my mind around. So maybe I don't have to work so hard trying to wrap my mind around every darn thing. And I've also found that it's possible to correct. When in the moment you see your thoughts start to go in a certain direction that's off the mark, it's possible to just come back. And I had this experience when I was the Doan at Rimunji some years back. And, you know, their book is different than ours, and some of their chants are slightly different than the way we do them here. And so anyway, and I was chanting the Heart Sutra in Sino-Japanese, which I'm not, you know, as solid with as the English. And as I was about maybe halfway through, I had this thought, I wonder where the echo for this is, because I could just kind of see, it wasn't at the bottom of the page, and I knew that sometimes they were like on the next page, and sometimes they were like over here on this side, and I didn't know where it was. So I'm chanting, the Mukugyo is going, and I just knew in that moment, if you move your eyes over here to see if it's there, you are done for. You will never find your way back. And there weren't a lot of people, so it's like if the Doan made a mistake, got off track, it would have been a train wreck. Probably. I mean, Shokin might have been able to save us, but. And it was really hard because I wanted to know. I wanted to know what was coming next. Like, that's important in life, right? To know what the next thing is so you can prepare. But I said, I just have to keep going here. And when I get to the end, I can make a big mistake. Like, if I can't find it, maybe it's nowhere. Maybe I turn the page and it's not there. And then I come back here and it's not there. Then I can make my big mistake in front of everyone. But that's what I need to do. And I felt like really it was my training that enabled me to do that. It wasn't like by my own power, but the power was cultivating being with what is, being uncomfortable, being willing to make a mistake, that allowed me to do that. So I could see, like, okay, here's the turning away and touching are both wrong. It's like I just need to be right here with what's going on, and let the future take care of itself. So I thought that was a pretty big teaching. It was really hard. It felt like to stay there.
What happened at the end?
It was right over here. So I got to the end, and then, oh yeah, it's right there. It is a standard for all things. So like I was thinking, what if we remove the it? Just say, a standard for all things removes all suffering, or removing all suffering. Or maybe it's referring to thusness being a standard for all things. So what does that mean, removes all suffering, or its use removes all suffering? So when you're suffering, if you remember, or I don't know if remember is the right word, but if you encounter suchness or thusness right in the middle of suffering, then the suffering is still there, but it's so transformed that it's not really suffering anymore. So this kind of happened to my dad. He's not a Buddhist practitioner, but he described it as grace, the grace of God. But I think that's kind of the same as, again, thusness or suchness, opening to that. So when my mom was, well, she had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, but then there was like a surgery that was either going to say, okay, we can do this procedure which will remove the cancer and, you know, and then whatever the outcome will be, or when we go in for the surgery, we might see that it's spread and that there's nothing that can be done. It can't be operated on. So anyway, it was the second one. It couldn't be operated on. There was nothing that could be done. And so we learned this, and of course it was very, very upsetting. It was a huge suffering, especially for my dad. I mean, they'd been married almost 50 years, so, and this was his best friend, his intimate, his lover, the mother of his children, everything to him, his whole world. And he talked about how he was just like suffering so much that it's like he was going to explode. And he said then he said it was like just this moment of grace, and all of a sudden, whew, and he said he just felt connected, and he was able to remember, oh, we've had a whole life together of love and beauty, and that's real too. This suffering is real. This ending of that is real, but everything else is real too. And then the suffering was taken away. Now, he had other times where it came back, so it's not like it was the end. But still, then he had the opportunity to remember, oh yeah, that's right. There is this grace. There is this end of suffering. So I've just got two more lines I'll say. Although it is not constructed, it is not beyond words. So this is, as Katagiri said, you have to say something. So it's not beyond words. It's okay to have words. And if we really want to save all beings from suffering, we can't be stingy with our words and stingy with the teachings. We need to try to express, even though we feel like it's inexpressible. So that's why I feel I'm kind of here fumbling with it and making mistakes, but that's okay. Like facing a jewel mirror, form and reflection behold each other. So there's you, so-called you, and so-called suchness. Behold each other. Also, I like this because it's about the name of our center as well, clouds and water. Clouds and water is about reflection of clouds and water. So there's the clouds, the this and that, the floating by, and then there's the water, the thusness, the absolute. And then, but in the absolute, the particulars are reflected. And I've used up almost the whole time, but I want to leave just a few minutes in case there is a comment. And I'd like, if Dokai has a comment, I'll go to him first, and then maybe one other. So thank you. And it's okay if you don't want to say anything. Don't want to put you on the spot.
Well, since you asked. I have no problem whatsoever to giving less talks.
So. Oh.
So that's good for me. But I will say, for me, this poem, I've recited it many, many times over the years, but this line of turning away and touching are both wrong has really kind of touched me. Because I'm either almost always doing one or the other. Turning away or touching are both wrong. So touching means you're trying to get something. Something's not satisfactory with just the way things are. So you want something more than what is. That's kind of trying to touch or reach something. And then turning away is pretty obvious. We're saying, oh, I don't like that. That's not what I want. So we're shifting our direction, turning away from something. So that's always been something I've looked at, and it also reminds me of another line that's been deeply moving to me in the Genjo Koan, where Dogen says, yet, after he goes through about what all this it is about, he says, yet in attachment blossoms fall, in aversion weeds grow. So we don't realize, I don't think, attachments, how deep it goes. The example is when we start to love someone or something, what will happen to me is I'll say, uh-oh, like, uh-oh, this could be a problem. I say, I got to be careful. I got to be careful about this. And so I'll keep saying, okay, be careful. But still, the attachment might continue to grow. And just as Sōsan said, then when you lose that thing, even though you knew you were attached to it, it just breaks you apart. Mm. It's like it goes so far beyond, what we're thinking. Our thoughts are telling us, getting attached, okay, slow down. Mm. But when it's gone, it's like, it just breaks your body apart. And then I say, how did this happen? But it's something that does happen. And then he says, in aversion, weeds grow. So that's really important too, that if we're turning away from something, you know, something's going to happen. It's called something like weeds, you know, weeds we don't like. They're going to start growing and growing. So we have to always attend to every moment. When the monk asked, what is beyond the three bodies of Buddha, and Dzogchen said, I'm always close to this, I imagine the monk didn't like that.
Yeah.
but it goes down. It goes down to, I'm here with you right now. I know that longing to, there's a longing, you want to know something that's beyond Buddha. And I know I have that longing too. So I'm right close to this. Right here, right now. Something else, the heron hidden in the moonlight, the silver bowl filled with snow. These are poetic metaphors. But when we see a heron, and I have the opportunity to see quite a few where I live, down at Hokkyoji, because there's lots of marsh and things, I'm always stopped. I see one standing there. Turn my head, and I got to make sure I don't go off the road because it's curvy and everything. But I always, you know, trying to look back at it. So I find, what is this fascination with herons that I want to look at them? My idea is that this poem was written 1,200 years ago, and we might think human beings have really changed a lot in 1,200 years, and I think we have. But herons have. Too much. Not only that, I researched it about, you know, when they were around, and they were around millions of years before human beings were. So when we look at it, we see something from the distant world before we were even as human beings happening. So, and then it says in the moonlight. So you're the heron in the moonlight. And where I live at Hokkyoji, when it's a full moon on a clear night, you walk out from Zazen, it stops you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where you're going, what you have to do. You look up and you're stopped for a minute, or maybe not a minute, not a whole minute, but, you know, 10 seconds. But that's a long time. You get stopped by something. So this moonlight is everywhere in the world. And it's common. It's something that we all see together. The herons are this unique thing. So it's the unique thing and the moonlight kind of together. It's the same with the silver bowl and snow. Putting a snow in a silver bowl, I don't know why anyone would do such a thing. but if it's a silver bowl, that's a very precious commodity. So we're struck by it. The snow, again, where I live, it's all over the place. So you just see it, and it's there, but it's beautiful, you know, when it is there. But you put them together, but it's the same world. So that's enough for me.
Thank you. So I think we should close.
Intention equally penetrate every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.
Beings are no